Hello and welcome to the Clinton Macomb Public Library podcast. I'm Phil Skeltis, Adult Services Librarian at our North Branch Library, and with me is Megan Mott, our Outreach Manager. Hello, Megan.
Hello.
Also, Kate Brown, Librarian in our Adult Nonfiction Department. Hello, Kate.
Hello.
And last but not least, Kate Mazzara, also a Librarian in our Adult Nonfiction Department. Hi, Kate.
Hi, everybody.
Today, we're going to talk about movies and TV series to get you through these long, cold days of winter. The library, of course, offers DVDs and Blu-rays for checkout, as well as online streaming the online streaming service Hoopla. If you haven't tried Hoopla before, definitely do check it out. You can download it for free from most app stores, and it allows you to stream movies and TV shows, as well as other digital content like ebooks, audiobooks, graphic novels, and stuff. For our recommendations today, we've got a mixture of mainstream movies and TV series and some not-so-mainstream movies and TV series that we love and hope you'll love, too. So Megan's going to start us off. Megan, what's your first pick?
My first pick is The Great, which I borrowed from the library on DVD because it originally aired on Hulu, which I do not have. Now that there are so many streaming services, it's like you can't have all of them. But I kept getting Instagram ads for The Great, and I thought, this looks beautiful. I wanna watch it. It turned out to be totally bonkers. The Great stars Elle Fanning and Nicholas Hoult, and it was described as one critic as the rambunctiously dark and anti-historical comedy. It's very loosely based on the life of Catherine the Great of Russia. And essentially the story is that Catherine of Prussia comes to Russia and she's full of enlightenment, idealism, and she is disappointed in her drunken, violent Tsar of Russia husband and his very loose grasp of actual politics and policies and, you know, ruling. But when I say loosely, I mean like very loosely. The facts of the story are wrong at the very beginning. And it's not a historical drama. Like The Crown, this is not. It's a satire and it's a comedy. It's very modern. It's laugh out loud funny. The mismatch between Peter and Catherine leads to like really bizarre situations. Peter is totally unhinged. And his court is all about revelry and drinking lots of vodka. But they're all also totally terrified that Peter is going to suddenly turn on one of them because he does that because he's like nuts. But the show is gorgeous. The costumes are gorgeous. The settings are gorgeous. Totally over the top.
Like I've seen commercials for it on Hulu. It does look like you say.
Yeah. It's like Bridgerton. If Bridgerton was crazy and way more interesting, in my opinion. And the acting is so good. Elle Fanning starts out as this like idealistic, naive young girl who's coming to be an empress, but she turns sort of ruthless. And she makes that transition believable. And Nicholas Hoult as Peter is also so good. His Peter is childlike and idiotic and sadistic until suddenly he'll do something that's actually kind of nice. It's usually short-lived, but he manages to make us want to like him. And I don't know why more people haven't seen this. Maybe because it's on Hulu, but we have it on DVD and I want more people to watch it. It's definitely for adults. Like, I would not watch this even with my teenager. And there's a lot of nudity, violence, and bad language and terrible people with way too much power.
But sounds great.
I'm sold. It.
Awesome, thank you.
Megan, is there only one season of this or is there two seasons?
There are two. The second one just came out on Hulu and we don't have it on DVD yet. I would imagine since we were able to get the first one, we'll be able to get the second one, but it hasn't been finished for very long. So
cool. I'll definitely watch for that one. And yeah, I'll definitely have to sell my wife on that. It sounds great. All right, Kate Brown, what have you got for us?
Oh, should I only say one of them and then we're going to go around again or say everything?
Just one for now. We'll go round robin.
Okay. The first movie I want to talk about is In the Heat of the Night, We just lost Sidney Poitier, such a great actor and important person. And I watched that movie. I had seen it before many years ago, but I just watched it recently. You know, we have it in DVD in the collection. Wonderful movie still. It was critically acclaimed at the time, Best Picture of 1968. The film actually came out in 67, but the Oscars were in 68. Rod Steiger plays across from Sidney Poitier, and he won Best Actor that year as well. It's based on a novel, 1965 novel. And the basic story, if you're not familiar with it, is Sidney Poitier plays Virgil Tibbs. He's been to a small town in Mississippi called Sparta in the film, and is now at the train station getting ready to go back to Philadelphia, when it turns up that an important citizen in the town is found dead in the street. And Sidney Poitier has significant money in his wallet. I mean, not a freakish amount, but he has a decent amount of money. He's an outsider. He's a Black man. And they decide that's good enough to arrest him for this crime. Very shortly after he's arrested, they find out that he is also a police officer and an expert homicide investigator. So when he calls his supervisor to explain to him what's going on there, and you know, they communicate that he is indeed an officer, his supervisor wants him to stay there and help solve the murder. And he doesn't want to at first, he just wants to go back. But you can guess what happens there. And he does wind up working with Rod Steiger very closely. Rod Steiger plays the chief of police of this small town. And there are moments that are really scary, where Sidney Poitier is alone, faced with, you know, 8 very scary looking white people with weapons. And he was instrumental in developing how this character responds to these situations. So one review I read said, if you want to know when race relations in movies changed, look at this movie. This is definitely a key movie. Sidney Poitier was involved in the civil rights movement. He had lots of conversations with the writer about what would the real response of this particular character be to some of these incidents that happened. So it's interesting from that point of view, from a historic point of view, but it's also really just a good, good movie. So I would awesome. Really recommend it. One of Kurosawa's favorite films.
Ooh.
By the way, yeah.
That's quite an endorsement.
Yep.
Cool. Well, thank you. Kate Mazar, what have you got?
Yeah, so I want to talk about a movie from 2019 that, to my knowledge, didn't win any awards or get much acclaim of any kind, but it should have. I know. It's called Blinded by the Light. Did anybody see that?
No, this doesn't sound familiar.
It's so good. It's actually like a musical. So the main character is this, he's probably about 15 or 16 years old. His name's Javed. His parents are immigrants from Pakistan to the UK. So this movie takes place in the UK in the 80s, and they live in sort of like a working class town, and the economy's not doing so well. So like at some point the dad gets laid off from the job that he has in town. The kid faces racism, like graffiti racism against him and his family. He's really interested in like writing and poetry, but he clashes with his dad, who wants him to like apply himself and work towards a more lucrative job. And he's sort of struggling. He's in a new school. He doesn't have a lot of friends. And then one day he meets the only other Southeast Asian kid in school. And that kid's dressed like Bruce Springsteen, basically. So he introduces him to the music of Bruce Springsteen, or as he says, the boss of us all. So
I'm picturing Denim on Denim.
And this was not like a time or place for a Bruce Springsteen fandom to be cool. Like, it was already like 10 years past like his popularity in America, and this was like these kids in the UK, so they were not cool to their peers. But they became best friends. And it is a musical. So they will burst into like musical numbers and singing and dancing. And eventually the issues between Javed and his dad do get resolved. I'm not going to give away the ending, but I think it would be pretty hard not to cry at this ending. And it's a true story.
Oh.
But then, in the movie, they show all these pictures of grown-up Javed and his friend at all these different Bruce Springsteen concerts. Like, I think he's been like 150 times or something. And
oh
like,
my gosh. He must have ended up with a lucrative career because I bet those tickets aren't cheap.
Right. But anyway, you guys should watch it.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Surprised
I hadn't heard of it.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of musicals, my first one up is a musical, In the Heights, from 2021. The likable, magnetic bodega owner, Usnavi, saves every penny from his daily grind as he hopes, imagines, and sings about a better life away from his home in the largely Hispanic and Latino neighborhood of Washington Heights and moving to the Dominican Republic. Meanwhile, his tight-knit community faces the challenges of gentrification, losing their homes, while trying to better themselves and hold on to their cultures. So, before there was Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda had a little Broadway musical called In the Heights. It was nominated for 13 Tonys, it won 4, and it was even nominated for a full Pulitzer Prize. It came out on Broadway in 2008 and shortly went on tour where I was lucky enough to see it in Chicago. And I thought it was great. And I think the movie version is every bit as good as the stage show, which you can't always say.
Wow.
You can definitely see how In the Heights was a precursor to Hamilton. It has a diverse cast. It has a hip hop score and excellent choreography. And in fact, In the Heights, the movie stars several of the original Hamilton cast members, including Anthony Ramos, who is great in the lead role, Chris Jackson, and Lin-Manuel Miranda himself. Aside from these similarities, they're two very different kind of musicals. Of course, one's about the foundations of U.S. democracy, whereas in the Heights, Usnavi is making a fool of himself trying to ask out a young woman in his bodega and very charming, very funny, but they're both very terrific in their own ways. I would say that In the Heights has kind of a lighter tone than Hamilton and is perhaps more fun and relatable than Hamilton. And the dancing is really fun to watch. There's a gravity-defying dance scene that takes place on the side of a building that's unique to the movie version that I thought was just awesome. I'm not giving anything away. If you see the poster for it, you'll often see that image on it, and it was just awesome. So if you like Hamilton, you'll definitely like In the Heights, so definitely check that one out.
So Phil, you said the dancing was unique to the movie version, because I saw the filmed version of Hamilton, and that was pretty much just like the stage play as a on screen. This is not?
So the stage version does have dancing. So I would say the only thing unique was the way they choreographed that scene on the side of a building where they're literally dancing on the side of a building, which can't happen in real life and can't happen on the stage. But other than that, there's a lot of dancing in the stage show too.
But it's more meant to be a movie. It's not a filmed version of the stage play.
Correct. That's right. It's not like the Disney Plus version of Hamilton. This is actually a cinematic adaptation of the stage show.
Got it.
Yeah.
I've been meaning to watch that, but I haven't gotten to it yet.
A lot of people said it was a play from like 2008 or whatever, because I remember seeing the preview for the 2021 movie and thinking like, I feel like this already exists.
Yeah, it's been kind of under the radar despite how successful it was. And the box office didn't do well for this. I'm like, why aren't people watching this? It's a great musical. That's your homework, everybody. Watch this.
All right. Is it appropriate for, what ages would you say it's for?
Oh, goodness. Junior high on up is probably... Okay. Fine, I would say. There's sexiness to it, but
nothing overt.
Nothing too bad.
Okay.
Nothing like some of my future, my upcoming recommendations. So Megan, I think, do you have another one, Megan?
I do. I have a couple that I'm going to talk about together. And these are both things that we actually do have on DVD, but they are also on Hoopla, One of my major selling points for people when they say, oh, Hoopla, oh, you can get it on your TV. That's weird. I'm like, it has BBC on it. It has Masterpiece Mystery, which those DVDs are hard to keep in stock. Like, I know that they're popular. I like to watch them. I think they're popular with lots of different age groups. But on Hoopla, there's no waiting. They're always available. The other thing with Hoopla is that you only get 7 checkouts a month, which can make binging a TV show difficult. But with BBC or Masterpiece Mystery Police Procedurals, sometimes there's only 3 or 6 episodes per season. So you can watch a whole series in, you know, a month with your checkouts, and then, you know, you're finished before you have to wait for more checkouts. So 2 of the ones that I have actually seen, there are a lot on Hoopla, but 2 that I've actually seen and that are over, so you're not necessarily waiting for new episodes, are Luther, starring Idris Elba, and Wallander, the BBC version. I didn't even know there is also a Swedish version, which is available on Hoopla.
Oh.
Wallander is based on a series of books by Henning Mankell. We do have the books, but Kenneth Branagh is in the English version, but he stars as a Swedish guy. I remember watching it and thinking, it is light out all the time. Why is it light out all the time? and then realizing, like, oh, it's Sweden. It gets light out at 4. Or it's light out till 11. Both of these are, you know, police procedurals. They're detectives with their own demons. They're flawed human beings who have to make hard choices, and they alienate all the people around them. But they always catch the bad guy, even when, you know, the people around them doubt their intuition. And I could watch police procedurals all the time. They're like comfort watching for me. So I would recommend both Luther and Wallander if you like that type of thing. If you like, you know, PBS or BBC, where they catch the bad guy at the end, I would recommend both of these. They're both, I would say, more on like the violent side, maybe nothing super graphic, but, you know, they're not cozy. So you have to be able to tolerate, you know, serial killers and sometimes, you know, children in danger. But they're both very good, and they both, yes, have 3 to 6 episodes per season. So you can easily consume them in 1 month's worth of borrows, and on Hoopla, they're always available.
Awesome. Thank you. Kate Brown?
Oh, one of my very favorite movies we have on DVD in the collection, and I have to admit, I was a little surprised. This is a movie that came out in 1998. It's a Japanese film. So while it's not exactly obscure, in fact, this is the one that the Criterion Collection just selected for re-release. And it did kind of put the writer and director, same person, it kind of put him on the map. It was pretty, you know, won a lot of awards at film festivals, that sort of thing. But still, I was sort of surprised when I looked it up and thought, yeah, there it is. In fact, I think it was checked out too. So I'm not the only one who likes this movie or was interested in it anyway. It's written and directed. The author is Hirokazu Koreeda. And it has the most interesting premise. People die and they go to a sort of way station, limbo kind of area. And it's nothing like I've ever seen before. It's just sort of this, probably, I can't decide. And I just looked at it again. I've seen this movie 3 times now, and I'm not sure, is it a school or is it like some sort of government building? But in any event, it's no longer being used for whatever its original purpose is. And now there are counselors, kind of like social workers, and there's the recently departed. And the building, the heat doesn't work, and it leaks, and it's dreary. It's not what I would call a beautiful movie in its appearance, because it's just a lot of mud, and it's just kind of in there. But it is beautiful, certainly in another way. So these people come, they arrive on a Monday, and they have 3 days to decide on a memory that they'd like to take from their life that they just experienced to the afterlife. And sometimes you'll see this written as they will exist forever within this memory, and that's what's going to happen to them. And sometimes you'll see it as, and I can't decide, maybe if I spoke Japanese, I would get this, but are they really going to do that, or are they just taking the memory with them to whatever comes next? That is not very well defined. There's no deities, there's no discussion of anything like that. So what it really is about is looking back over your life and picking a memory that would be the key memory that you'd want to keep, which of course inspires fascinating discussions, great date night kind of movie, you know? And the questions, you know, that's pretty straightforward. Once they do decide on the movie though, this crew of people there, the counselors, social workers, whatever they are, who, why ever they're there, that's a question that you begin to wonder about and does get addressed at some point. Who are the people who work at this place? So they make a little movie of whatever the experience was, the best they can with what they have around, which isn't always the greatest stuff. They don't have CGI or anything. They actually have to make props and, you know, incorporate noises. And they try to get all the memory, like, what did it smell like? What sounds were there? Were there other people there? You know, they have to try to get it as good and as realistic as they can. And then the person who had the memory is in the film. Then on a certain day, Saturday actually, they all watch the films. And once you see yourself in that film, you disappear, you vanish. So that's how the movie goes. But I'm not really giving a lot away. That's sort of the bare bones plot of it, because there is the question of who are the people are there. And there's also connections between the people who work there, at least one significant connection, and one of the recently dead people. What if you can't think of a memory, as one character can't? So what they do is they go to an archivist and they get the archives of the person's life. And he even tells him, your memories may be different from what's filmed here. Just use it as a, you know, to kind of inspire your thinking about your life. And they come in these big reels, and they're just grainy footage that you watch, and the guy's watching it to try to decide what will be the moment. Yeah. So what does happen if you can't decide on one moment, as some people can't? So that's another interesting issue. When the script was being developed, the Corita filmed, I think, 500 people, regular people from all walks of life, Japanese people, but from all different kind of areas and different kind of lives, and asked them this question about their life and what memory that they would take with them. And he incorporates that footage. It was shot by a documentary filmmaker, kind of a well-known documentarian, and it was shot on 16mm. And it's incorporated into the movie. So at times you're watching a real person talking about their life and their memory, and it's sort of woven into the story. So just beautifully done. And it makes you think about memory. What does memory have to do with identity? What, you know, life and death and all of that. And just winds up the feeling of it is a very beautiful feeling ultimately, even though the setting is, you know, not very nice. So fascinating movie called Afterlife. The title in Japanese actually translates to Wonderful Life. Of course, not everybody's life is wonderful, but the guy who can't decide what he wants to do is because his life has been so completely uneventful that he doesn't think he has anything special.
No.
But what winds up being special to people is very interesting, and I would say a bit heartwarming. So it's kind of an emotional film while also being sort of an intellectual exercise. Really, I mean, I've seen it 3 times. I'm sure I'll see it 3 more times in my life. It's one that you could watch repeatedly and get something new out of each time.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing that.
I want to watch that for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm already thinking about, well, what memories do I have? And do I really want to keep that? Or is that just a memory that, like, I think about, but it's not necessarily one I want to live in?
Yeah.
Right.
Disneyland comes up when a young girl dies and her trip to Disneyland, and she talks about that. And then she's told that pretty much everyone her age says Disneyland. And
she's thinking,
like, gives it a little bit more thought, you know, because the first things that you think of, you know, oh, what's the peak experience, the most fun? It's not always that really kind of sums it up, or what you would take with you. Interesting question, anyway.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you. Kate Mazzara?
So I was going to talk about one of my all-time favorite movies, which is from 2008, and it's called Be Kind, Rewind. And this is a movie by a guy named Michel Gondry. He's most famous for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
I love that.
Yeah, it was great. Ooh. And if you think of any like weird, quirky music video from the 90s and 2000s, he probably made it, directed it. So in this movie, it stars Mos Def. He has since changed his name. I should have looked up what his new name is, but at this point, he's still called Mos Def, and Jack Black. And Mos Def works in a video store. The owner of this video store is Danny Glover. And Mos Def always wants more responsibility, but Danny Glover just wants to run things and just have him as an employee. Then Danny Glover goes away. Oh, and in the meantime, the video store that they work at is under threat of being torn down because like the city wants to put some luxury development there. And it's 2008, so there's very few video stores even left. And they are pure VHS stores, like no DVD, even in 2008. Very old school. And this is a comedy. So Danny Glover ends up having to go out of town, and he leaves the video store in Mos Def's care. And he says, as he's leaving on the train, just please take care of the store and don't let your friend anywhere near it. The friend is Jack Black, and he's really like wild conspiracy theorist, strange person. So, you know, Jack Black's the comedy relief and Mos Def is kind of like the straight man. So what ends up happening is Jack Black is wandering near some like power plant or something and gets electrocuted. And then he stumbles into the video store, and it turns out his body is magnetized. So it erases all the VHS tapes in the store. So they have to make the movies themselves. So the first one they make is Ghostbusters. So they get like a little home video camera and go to the library. And like the production value of their movies is so just comically bad. Like, you know, here's a ghost, but you can clearly see like strings and stuff. So they end up making a bunch of different movies with them as the actors. And the movies end up getting popular. And so they start charging not just $1 for rentals, but now $20 because these movies are so popular. Wow. And so then it's just sort of a question, will this save the business or what's going to happen in the end? And they call these movies that they make sweeted because they try to say, like, if anyone questions like why this movie seems a little off, just say it's from Sweden. So if you go on YouTube and look up a trailer of this movie, it's a sweeted version of the movies. Like, it's kind of meta. Like, it's a sweeted version of actual scenes that are not sweeted in the movie. But anyway, it's a really cute, goofy comedy that I think was very underrated and overlooked.
That awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a vague recollection of that, but now I'm trying to remember if I actually saw it or if I only saw the preview. So yeah. I'll have to check it out. Cool. Thank you. My next one is No Time to Die from 2021. James Bond has left active service. His peace is short-lived when Felix Leiter, an old friend from the CIA, turns up asking for help, leading Bond onto the trail of a mysterious villain armed with a dangerous new technology. So this could be the plot of any James Bond movie, really. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start with a disclaimer. I love all James Bond movies, even the terrible ones. But I'm happy to say that this one was genuinely good. This was Daniel Craig's final Bond movie, and its release was delayed many times due to COVID. And if you're like me and you stayed away from movie theaters during the pandemic, you'll be happy to know that No Time to Die is now finally out on DVD and Blu-ray. So you don't need me to explain the basic ingredients of a Bond movie. So I'll just kind of share my general impressions. I was pleased that I actually understood the plot, so that already puts it above some of the more convoluted Bond movies. Rami Malek of Mr. Robot fame, he made a pretty good Bond villain, very understated, so maybe not as memorable as some of the more eccentric villains of years past, but he did have an old-fashioned underground lair on a remote island, so he could be forgiven some of his lack of charisma. His world-threatening weapon of choice is biological in nature, which felt kind of pertinent in the age of COVID. So I'm going to skip ahead. So the women in Bond movies don't always get the respect they deserve, so I want to point out a particularly memorable scene. This isn't giving anything away, and you've probably even seen parts of it in the preview, but Ana de Armas was one of the women of Bond in this movie. She was wearing an elegant gown and heels at a black tie event, and she helps a tuxedoed Bond get out of a jam in a very memorable way. It's almost like a tango dance number with choreographed kicks and spins and leaps. And of course, machine gun bursts, because it's a Bond movie. She practically stole the whole movie with this brief scene. People are already calling for her to have a spin-off movie. So I just wanted to point out that that high point. There's a bit more humor in this one compared to other Bond movies. And I think that's because they had screenplay contributions from Phoebe Waller-Bridge, very funny comedic actor, writer, and producer from shows like Fleabag and Killing Eve. I think she kind of punched up the script and just kind of made it a lot more fun. So all in all, very satisfying conclusion to the Daniel Craig Bond movies.
I thought he made a great Bond. I really enjoyed
it. Me too. A lot of people doubted him, but he came through. So Kate Brown and I think have one more apiece. We're running long. Let's see. Do you have enough time to do the fast version?
Sure. I can just say that basically the title of it, and this is a mini series, came out in 1983, The Winds of War. It is very much based on the book by the same name by Herman Wouk, and W-O-U-K. He wrote the screenplay for the miniseries. Did I say it ran 18 hours? And unlike the two movies I discussed, which were pretty critically acclaimed universally, this was not so much. And actually the Washington Post review, if you want to read something funny, a guy named Tom Schultz, I think, wrote it. And it was Tom Shales. His review is so bad of this that it's funny. Two words that he used were bloated and bulbous was another one. I disagree, though, because for one thing, the books are considered impeccably researched. Same guy wrote the miniseries and the sequel to it, which is War and Remembrance. And so while you have your big events of World War II in this that we all know about, there are also go into battles, operations, and I was looking them up on the iPad. Is this real? Is this how it really went down? And over again, it does look like the history that's happening, which is the buildup to World War II. It starts in 1939, and the first series ends with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So it just takes it to the American involvement. But of course, Europe is very much involved already, and Hitler's on the rise. And it focuses on one family. The family is fictional. So while the setting and all of that is very realistic, the things that happen with the family and their loves and inappropriate relationships and marital issues and all of that are just made up for the story. I just found it totally entertaining. I didn't plan to watch the whole thing. I just started it and thought, is this anything? And turned out that it was fascinating. It does star Robert Mitchum. He plays Pug Henry, is the main character, Pug's nickname. And Robert Mitchum was 66 at the time. Pug Henry in the book is 49. And Robert Mitchum looks every day of 66. So that was one of the sort of criticisms that a lot of people mentioned, is that everyone cast in this was a good 10 years older than they should have been, sort of for how they were in life, you know, especially in 39, you don't expect people to be still sort of drifting and wandering around, not knowing what they're doing, let alone an unmarried woman at 44. Who looks 44, and should really be probably in her late 20s, especially when the love interest says to her, I'm going to have 6 kids with you. And you're thinking,
hey, and you're doing the math.
Yeah, right. Like, I'm not sure that's physically possible. And it was Ally McGraw who played that part and was really her performance in it pretty much universally condemned. Not just that she's, you know, way too old to be playing this young woman, but that her acting style wasn't quite right. In the sequel, the same part is played by Jane Seymour, and the sequel got a lot better reviews. But I really enjoyed it. No CGI in this. When they have to have a plane flying through the clouds, you're talking about models and cotton and ships that are actually toy boats and ponds. And I just think they did a great job with it, with what they had at the times. It was very expensively done. Large, large cast. If somebody's getting out of a 1939 car, there are 6 other 1939 cars parked on the street. Everything looks really good, especially considering, oh, no special effects. One more thing is they used real footage for some of the bombing sequences in Germany and in England. So I don't know. I haven't seen their sequel, but I think I will watch it more in remembrance. This one is called The Winds of War. Oh, and we have both of the books. They're both over 1,000 pages long.
Oh, boy. That's awesome. Well, some of my favorite things have lousy reviews, so I'm glad you stand by your conviction. All right. Well, I've got one last quick one. Emily in Paris from 2020. There's a season 2 out now on Netflix, although not the season 2 isn't yet on DVD yet, I don't think. I can't remember. But either way, season 1 is definitely available. After suddenly landing a dream job in Paris, Chicago marketing exec Emily Cooper embraces her adventurous new life. Emily says, "We." to possibility as she juggles work, friendship, and romance while navigating a whole new culture. This is a Golden Globe Award and Emmy nominated series from Darren Star, the creator of Sex and the City. So my wife and I are big fans of Sex and the City, at least the original show, not so much the sequel that's out now. And it's no surprise that we love Emily in Paris. Their budget must be astronomical because most of the show is filmed in all the prime locations in Paris. They'll take over an entire block, and it's just so fun to look at. My wife and I went to Paris right before COVID, so it's been fun to try to figure out where they are in each scene. Lily Collins, the daughter of singer Phil Collins, is the title character, and she does a great job playing a perpetual optimist, a fish out of water social media marketing expert in a country that's not known for embracing self-confident Americans who don't speak any English. The French cast is excellent too, and like Sex and the City, fashion plays a big part in the show because, you know, it's Paris. This one is for mature audiences only. So just be aware of that. It's a little deceiving at first because the tone is light and funny, and it has kind of the pristine look of a Hallmark movie almost. Trust me, this is no Hallmark movie, but it is a lot of fun. And it makes me long for the days when travel was safer and easier. But it's a great way to see the beauty of Paris from the comfort of home. That's all I have before my outro. Does anyone else have anything else they wanted to share?
No, but I'm looking forward to watching all this stuff.
I know. Lots of good recommendations. I haven't seen anything that anybody recommended. It's crazy.
Yeah, likewise. Well, we've got our homework cut out for us. I just want to say one last thing. I am now the primary purchaser of DVDs and Blu-rays for the library. So if you notice any gaps in our collection, feel free to let any librarian know. They'll pass it along to me, or you can fill out our suggested purchase online form on our website, and those will find their way to me also. A lot of movies and shows initially get snatched up by streaming services like Netflix or Apple Plus, but I keep an eye on those. And as soon as they come out on DVD and Blu-ray, I will snatch them up and buy them for the library. Thank you all so much for joining us, and have a great rest of winter. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.